that has big time camp. What the movie will be the ultimate champ. You might be finger crazy, my finger diseased, but do you watch another chance to find the best of this?
We rate each movie in 5 categories, none of which are objective quality.
It's Stan, Gene, Jack and Nick who watch it till it's finished, because the love for this movie can be diminished. And make the film's plot has no rhyme or reason, but that's a part of charm.
Colin Brad is off the season.
It's low budget film that is most true. They find a flick that monster boogaloo.
Kung Fu Electric Boogaloo. Kung Fu Electric Boogaloo. Kung Fu Electric Boogaloo. Kung Fu Electric Boogaloo.
Yark Mala, Yark Mala. Welcome back, my friends, to the Kung Fu Electric Boogaloo. I am your host, 8th Dan Stanadu. Super happy to be with you to wrap up Season 11, Enter the Octagon. And we are wrapping up Season 11 with Jim Cotta's I Hate Sand, It Gets Everywhere. Say hello, Jim.
Hi, I am thrilled to be here. I'll take it where I can get it.
There you go. And
you said say hello, Jim.
Oh, we're so good at this. Yes. And then speaking of taking it where he can get it, Jack Hall.
Say hello, Jim.
Oh, hey, hello, Jim.
And to complete this trinity of terror,
comedy goals. Yes, comedy goals,
okay. We have Nick Boxer.
Greetings and salutations, Jim.
That one's left over from Nick's vaudeville days.
Yeah, that's right. Who is on first? But the bigger question is, who is joining me on the road to hell? Because I think that we're all on that road. So, you know, and the
we
person,
did watch Food Fight.
The person, though, who truly has to go on that road to hell is Nick when he explains this movie. but first, we'll get a little bit of history of this whole his season concept and where Road to Hell came from first.
And the concept of the actual season we're doing here is that every show that we're doing represents a potential season, and they're competing for the highest score of the season, and that will be how we choose next season. A lot of seasons.
I will explain that then. Yeah.
Be sure to explain that.
If you want to, just lift that audio and put it in as if I had said it. So Enter the Octagon, we are... these 8 films are competing for what will be season 12. And this sub-season that is going into the Octagon is I Hate Sand, It Gets Everywhere. That is a season, if it should be chosen by the Boogaloo gods, by the saints, then it would be films on, in, or adjacent to sand.
And so speak about Road to Hell, and because there's a backstory to Road to Hell. So tell us why you chose Road to Hell.
Yeah, and why it isn't a Wynorski movie.
There are some Wynorski films in the sand. This film has been out for, was first shown at festivals years and years ago. I'm sure Jack has some backstory.
2008.
Yes. Quite a long time ago. Has never had a theatrical release, has never had a wide distribution deal. It was for a time available streaming on the director Albert Payoun's website, which I never wanted to do because I had no idea where that credit card information would go from Albert Payoun's website.
It wasn't cheap either.
No, it was not. It was like $12 or something. $18, I think it was.
The 2008 cut also was 65 minutes. So, I mean, I think it was 2013 or 2014. They filmed an additional 20 minutes to make it a full-length film.
Yeah, and I think there are 3 versions of this film. Because there was the original that showed us some festivals. There is a an 85 minute cut, and then there's an extended 90 minute cut, which is the one I bought because it finally became available on a print on demand Blu-ray site. And I paid, I'm not going to say what I paid, but it's in the neighborhood of what I pay for my Criterion films. I'll just say that.
Money well spent.
And the reason I wanted to see it mostly is that it is the sequel to Streets of Fire, the cult classic film from the 1980s starring Michael Perry.
Pseudo sequel. That's important to say.
I'm sure we'll get into it. IMDb's credits are charitable. They say follows as opposed to sequel or anything else.
Makes sense. Follows. Makes sense.
And some stuff happens in it, and I, you know, God bless you, Nick, for having to tell us what it is.
That's right. Go for it, Nick.
Oh God.
Always my favorite part of the show.
So this film, as it's mentioned, takes follows or diarrhea something or other Streets of Fire, one of my favorite movies of all time. And this movie's done by Albert Payoun, who I absolutely love. I wanted to see this movie so freaking bad for so long, but I wasn't willing to go out and spend this kind of money on what I suspected this might be and is. Here's the story. It follows the hero of Streets of Fire, Tom Cody, played by Michael Paré, 20 years after this, what goes on in, or I guess it would be 18 years after what goes on in Streets of Fire. He's obviously gone back to war or just has brooded on his war experiences for the last 18 years. Nothing much happens. But he is on his way across country on the roads from hell to either catch up or kill his love interest from that film in Edge City. Along the way, he encounters and briefly teams up with, I'd like to say briefly, but it takes a really long time, a pair of female spree killers. He detains one of them and then spends a really long time talking to the other one while she's tied up and decides to team up with her, but then in a moment of self-defense guts her for no apparent reason, and for some reason there's the baby in the trunk.
Well, that's the reason why he guts her, when he finds that she has kidnapped him.
I thought she tried to grab her knife for the second time.
No, that's what he kills her for that reason. That went too far for him.
But he does. He was going to team up with her there. That was just weird. Not to mention that until the baby shows up, he doesn't really know they're spree killers. I don't know. And then finally he makes it to Edge City, where he finds out the love interest that he was coming to hook up with again or kill, it's never made clear, died like 20 years ago, killed by the comic relief from the first film. But his daughter is there, and she tells him that her mother was killed, and he's leaving her again to go kill him. I don't know.
But I think
this might actually be your most accurate representation of a good plot. Yes, that's the scary part.
Yeah, it's a good summary. I mean, it misses like pretty much all of the middle of the film as far as understanding.
I wish I missed all of the middle of this film. Film is... And how could I miss the middle of the film? The last half is the same song sung over again. In full length.
No, it is not. There's two wonderful Jim Steinman songs that they pull from the first movie that they perform, and then she does one of her
own. Performed badly. I actually had to watch Streets of Hell to get this version out of my head.
Well, I enjoyed it. I think the performer, Roxy Gunn, the real-life performer, I think she's magnificently talented. I thought she did a great job with the songs.
Really? Perfect. I actually had to look her up to determine that she wasn't directly related to Albert Byun. Well, I thought maybe she was trying to launch something out of this movie.
Well, and that's really what it looks like, because because of the people who wrote it, and like it comes from a short story, and then you have Roxy Gunn, and you have Albert Payoun in his 50th movie, just in case you hadn't noticed that. And, you know, there's just, like, it seems like there's all these disparate elements that have been brought together to form Road to Hell. And what's exceptional about it is that I would swear that at least 75% of it is shot on green screen.
Oh yeah, somebody bought themselves a green screen. That's what I wanted to say.
It's definitely on green screen.
But isn't the advantage of green screen being able to change the background?
Well, they do a lot. They change it too.
No. They change the background with the actors. But I'm pretty sure Michael Paré acted in front of the same sunset for the entire freaking movie.
Well, 75% of the movie takes place with the only real set being a Jeep.
Yes.
So, like, it's...
And how do you do a Streets of Fire follow-up without having cool vintage vehicles?
Well, you shoot it primarily against green screen, and yeah. You have Michael Paré, you know, brood in front of the camera, and so you can take that and reuse that shot about 48 times.
When did he become an evil fuck?
Well, they tried to explain that during the, you know, when he went back to war. He found that he liked killing so much, and then he sort of became a serial killer. I mean,
see, I wasn't sure if he ever went back to war, because in the first film, he was just back from war.
Yeah, I think he did. Now, it's a couple things. Number one, I was really hoping you would explain, like, right before he gutted that woman. Or maybe, no, it's right after he gets run over by a woman in a car, and I don't know who that woman is. I was really hoping you were going to tell us that.
I want to say that's McCoy. But maybe not.
Yes, it could be.
That couldn't have been McCoy.
From the first film again. So so we say that Tom Cody, of course, is the character from Streets of Fire. In this film, he's only referred to as Cody. The movie opens up with a quote from some character named Cody E. Wilson. So I assume that it's Cody E. Wilson, but they never call him that during the film. And they have that quote. I imagine this is all to make it ambiguous enough that they can't get sued. Like, oh, no, it's Cody E. Wilson. It's a different character, even though they refer to other characters from the movie, from the Streets of Fire movie. But, yeah, so I assume this character is supposed to be Tom Cody, but he's actually Cody E. Wilson, I think. But, again, it's such a cluster.
I have that quote pulled up here. I was going to save it for WTFs.
It's certainly right away, as soon as you read that, you immediately know that this is going to be a very different movie from Streets of Fire.
I really thought this was going to be the linchpin to understanding what the fuck was happening in this movie. So I've read it several times, and it still doesn't make any sense.
No, it doesn't make any sense.
People use fucking highways and fucking freeways and fucking streets, but old roads are special. Were special. You could find grace and even an angel on the road. Now all the angels are working the fucking roadsides and strip clubs. What the fuck does that mean?
Well, it means that, you know, the women are all working the, you know, roadsides and strip clubs. Now, I thought that this movie was going to be way more Mad Max style, the way that reads. Like, It sounds like, oh, we're going to go crazy and then you go into the, what was the first character? Was that the Angel Gabriel? I forget.
Yeah, it was Angel Gabriel, yeah.
Yeah, I'm thrown off by none of you understanding the point of the film. She's the Angel Gabriel. He's going through hell.
Mm-hmm.
Literally, they're in purgatory. And then he punishes the two murderers and gets to come back. That's what actually happens in this movie. And they tell you that at the beginning of the film.
He punished the two murderers. Okay.
Yeah. They tell you that that's what happened.
Okay, I got that he was in purgatory. All that I got, and Gabriel, played by Joey Foco, who's a contestant on the Voice this year.
Wow. So, but yeah. I guess I didn't quite realize that when he got to Edge City that was coming back. That's fair.
See, I got what you're saying, except I thought it was symbolism, not a literal thing in the movie. So the highway he's on is actually hell.
Yeah, you have to understand.
Purgatory, yes.
He's on the highway to hell.
Don't they? I mean, it is the road.
They do call it purgatory.
It is purgatory. Like, it's purgatory, and purgatory is where you get judged. And he punishes the two women who have been on this kill crazy spree, and he gets to come back.
No, I didn't realize he gets to come back for that, but because his character is also evil in many ways, and so sort of, I don't know.
Does the baby represent?
Pardon me?
What? The weird ass baby in the trunk. How does that work in?
I don't know. They didn't tell me that. They explained the rest of it.
They didn't explain. I assumed that they, because those spree killers had killed, including that this is the daughter of the character played by William Dafoe. I can't remember the name again. The oldest one was the daughter of William Dafoe's character and killed him.
That's the little bit at the end.
Yeah, and so, yeah, I mean, that kid, I imagine, it's like she's talking about it like it's her kid, but I think it's just one that they kidnapped when they killed all these other people or something. I don't know.
I think like she is Cody's salvation. The fact that he was tempted to go off with the one spree killer, that would have led to his damnation. But the fact that he saved the child and therefore killed the final spree killer led to his salvation.
Maybe, but I think you're giving a lot of credit to the screenwriter, who is Albert Payne's wife.
Well, I love the fact that this is a rock and roll fable that is essentially, you know, it's not like it's weaved deftly into the storyline or anything like that. No, it's just like there's rock and roll music that plays, and then there's a concert at the end. That's kind of your rock and roll fable to this element.
Yeah, it's got a certain dreamlike quality.
Oh, does it ever?
Somebody bought themselves a green screen.
this is way unlike anything else we've seen before.
True. We're still having new experiences.
Yeah, and that's the fantastic element. I mean, whatever you think of this movie, like, and it's not. I mean, here's the thing, right? It's not like in the same vein of fun to watch as maybe a Deadly Prey or a Ninja, but there's no question that it's crazy. And we still look for crazy.
Yeah, it's crazy.
It is crazy. It's weird because I liked it, but I didn't like it for the qualities of necessarily a Boogaloo thing, but because I like the music. I particularly think, like I said, I think Roxy Gunn really talented. It is amazing to me. She never got a record deal, not even an independent release, anything like that. You know, she's still out there playing, but nothing. But I thought she's really good.
The soundtrack. I think you need to go listen to the original Streets of Rage version before you say that, because I mean, the original version is so much better. I love the version.
You can't compare the two.
It's the same song.
It's 3 minutes long. I'm allowed to have both of them.
I like both of them. Yeah, I love the original. It's Jim Steinman. Don't get me wrong. But that doesn't mean I don't like this, too. And that doesn't mean I don't think she's got a great voice and that she performs well. And I like her other music in this. I bought the soundtrack to this. $10. $10.50. Because that's the only way you can get it. It's not available to stream anywhere. It's very rare. The soundtrack was available on Google Music and Amazon Music. I bought it because I liked it enough. But I also have listened to many times the Streets of Fire and all the Jim Steinman stuff and everything like that. So, I mean, I think I can enjoy a bunch. If I had to choose one, yes, I would choose the original. But it doesn't mean I don't think that this is good.
Now, can I just say that I absolutely love the fact that Nick has referred to this movie as Streets of, or the original movie as Streets of Hell and Streets of Rage. Never Streets of Fire.
And how much he loved it.
Yes. Yeah.
And isn't that a
untouchable classic game? That he can't remember the name of?
Streets of Rage?
It's a video game. I love
it. It is a video game.
Oh, that's great.
That they couldn't get the rights to for Streets of Fire, I believe.
I imagine the reason why this one is so hard, I would imagine it would be because they would have to pay Jim Steinman, who is, you know, the massive, right? Like, well, huge.
And I mean, he's credited, Johnny, of course.
Presumably you can just, you can record a cover of anyone. You just pay them, you know, percentage of the song. So that's all they would do in this. It's just a cover version of songs that you can.
And they credited him with them with. Yeah,
it's not like they didn't steal them.
I didn't say they stole them. I'm just saying that I imagine that.
But like, they would be.
That's why it isn't. I don't know. I don't know what the deal is. Like if they're paying for their cover, do they only have to pay one time, or do they have to pay every time it's a, you know, like what is the rules on that?
I don't actually. Typically residuals are forever or for 20 years, or they're usually for a length of time.
It could also why it's never reached a larger distribution.
That's what I'm saying. Yeah.
Yeah. It could be hung up somewhere. I think that it's so tongue in cheek sequel to Streets of Fire is probably the big thing, because you know, you're arguing that he's not called quite, he's not given quite the same name. Most of the names aren't, I mean, at the very end, we get the full names of other characters. So you need some attack lawyers to try to figure that part out.
I did like the credit for the sister.
Yes, that was fantastic.
Yeah.
Sister.
Yeah. So maybe there are certain characters that were owned by the original rights holder. Like, it's a bit of a dance to try to get around that part while not being like, clearly not having total permission, because they don't lean into it either. Like, they make a point of stepping around it.
Yeah. Yes, they had to. I mean, I'm not sure what the budget was, but it's not like they could have paid for. I mean, because isn't it a Universal film, Streets of Fire?
No idea.
Well, either way, this is not a Universal film.
No, it's an Albert Payoun film. It's 50th, yeah. In fact.
It's 50th.
I heard somewhere it was 50.
Yeah. And his 51st was going to be another Nemesis movie. I wonder if it actually was. Well, what do you think?
Probably was.
Yeah. Do we
get to scoring?
To scoring?
Well,
because we do have to announce the next movies, and I am looking forward to that part for next season.
Well, it's not the best film of Jonathan Ross. I don't think it's the worst, but it might be the weirdest.
When I said Spookies was weird, I'd like to now say my bad.
Yeah, it had nothing on this for weirdness. No, that's for
nothing
sure.
Nothing at all.
All right. In our search for the ultimate B movie, we rate each film in 5 categories. None of these categories are objective quality. The first category we call schlock appeal, and we start with Stan.
Well, I think this movie is chock full of schlock. It's the weirdest schlock I've ever seen, and like I say, I'm not completely sure that I enjoyed watching it, but at the same time, I recognize that they did this amazing job of, you know, green screening things. It's like an art house monster piece that is completely, you know, pompous in moments, and just like, it's all over the place. So it's really Boogaloo in my mind. I'm going with an 8.
This is a follow-up to an unsuccessful movie with the original stars without the rights. 8.
makes good sense to me.
Well, 2 original stars. They managed to bring back probably arguably the weakest person in the original movie, which was Michael Paré.
You bite your tongue. Yeah.
Probably the weakest part of that movie. I love him in some things, but in that film, it's weird, because I don't think it's schlocky. It's different. I don't find it to be a very Boogaloo movie, but an interesting movie, and like I say, something I enjoyed. So I'm going to give it a 6.
I think Nick and Stan have won me over. I'll say an 8 on this as well. The next category is called More Heart Than Budget.
Well,
and we don't know what the budget was.
No, I mean
any of the three versions.
Yeah, yeah.
And it's so hard when it's filmed in, you know, 5 years apart and things tacked on and clearly filmed in wherever he had a green screen, you know.
Yeah. I mean, to me, like, the budget looked somewhere around $12 plus whatever they paid for Michael Paré. Because I, for a moment there, I actually wondered if he was in the movie or if it was just that they got him for 2 hours, stuck him in front of a green screen and took profile pictures of him. But,
for the first 20 minutes, I actually thought they were using a photo. Because he didn't move.
It took a long time before he had any dialogue in this. It is possible, you know, that they were filming stuff without filming the camera. that's what brings up, just because Albert Payun is great. He's one of our favorites. One of the best stories was how when he was doing Captain America, they ran out of money, but he didn't have the heart to tell the crew, and he didn't want them to quit in case they got more money, so he filmed the day with no film and a camera.
To me, like, no matter what you think of it, no matter how much sense it makes or doesn't make, the fact is that they wanted to make this movie. They wanted to make a sequel to this, and it is something else. And I don't necessarily know what that is, but this is a vision, and they had a vision. So I'm giving it a 9.
That's high, but I see where you're going. I mean, Albert Payun did dedicate this to his children.
Those were his dogs.
Yes. Were those his dogs?
Yes, those were his dogs.
But oddly enough, the dogs did some other shooting in this movie as well, which is kind of weird.
But, I mean, their names are great. Chiba and Naboo. So, I mean, you got a classic Japanese...
His daughter, Chiba and Naboo, the dogs.
I didn't know that. I just assumed. who dedicates a film to their dogs? But anyway, that's points anyway. They didn't have the rights yet. They made this movie anyway. I'll go as high as a 7.
I mean, Albert Payun loves Streets of Fire, one of his favorite films of all time. This film came about because his wife and him had an argument over what would happen after Streets of Fire ended. You know, she thought that this is where he would go off and this is what would happen to Cody. And Albert Payun thought that, you know, everything would be peachy keen. He thought it was like the most romantic ending ever. And his wife wrote this and they filmed it. And like, it's like, we've seen this from Albert Payun before. Like he, when he gets a little bit too arty, he is probably one of the better, like, most of his crappy movies is because he had no control over that. You know, like, I think he is a talented guy within his genre and you know, in his world. So I think this was very important to him. I feel the love in this movie. I think they really tried. I have a 9.
As far as I know, he went out of pocket to make his 50th film a basically fan fiction. Yeah. I don't know how you go lower than a 10, so 10 for me.
You know, I'll go with a 10 then. I agree.
I'm going to 10.
Yep.
I don't want to throw anything off, so I'll just throw in with you guys 10. No, I see the logic there, but...
Peer pressure takes over the octagon. what the fuck moments.
This one is a little harder for me because there's a lot of, like, through the entire first 30 minutes, I was just like, what the fuck is going on? And thankfully, you know, once you start getting into it, it's just once you start understanding the visual style of everything that it just takes some time to get there. And then, you know, about the 1 hour mark, I'm like, well, how much more do they have to story to tell here? It feels like they're wrapping it up, and then thankfully there's 20 minutes of concert that kind of helps up with that. You know? So by that token, it's like, what the fuck is the concert? I think the one part where I was really confused was like the girl whoever she was, when she was driving and talking on the phone, she hits Cody and and never appears again.
Not only does she hit Cody, I'd like to point out, while she hits him, he's leaning against the car and touching the girl that he had just stabbed. Both of them don't get touched at all by this car that hit him.
Oh, and the girl in the car, is just like, oh, I must have hit a coyote or something. That doesn't happen. You hit a human, the car gets impacted, you know that you hit something. But
it feels a little different than a coyote. Yeah.
I know this, but it's just one of those cases. It's really weird. I can't go crazy high because we're not talking about all the random elements of, say, Terror in Beverly Hills, but there's it feels what the fuck to me, so I'll go with a 6.
Yeah, I'm having trouble with this one too. I think to get a WTF from any film, you have to understand the movie's internal logic, which obviously at this point I do not get what's going on. So you know what, I'm just gonna middle of the road it and just say 5. I'm sure it's either more WTF or less, and I can't tell which.
Yeah, I get where you're coming from. I struggle with this one, too. Definitely, I think things like that. I think the speech with the girl gives, the whole subplot with the kid, the baby in the trunk, for instance. All that is WTF, the dialogue by its nature is supposed to be hyper, just kind of unrealistic. All the incredible amount of profanity thrown in for a sequel to Streets of Fire, which is PG, is certainly WTF to me. It's there. There's WTF elements. The entire ending is WTF to me.
If the baby was crying, do you think it would have made more sense? I think it
that
would.
Baby looks like
and it
baby
wasn't a baby.
Legit.
It was like a 7-year-old.
No, it was a 3-year-old.
Well,
they said it was a 3-year-old.
Couldn't they have poked it with a pin or something to get movement out of it?
I
thought it was
looks,
a doll the first two times they showed it.
That kid looked legit scared to me. I don't think that was acting. I don't think anybody told him what was going on. I'm pretty sure they just picked up that kid, put some dirt on his face, threw him in a car, and said, "We're going to film you now." That looked very strange, but. Yeah, I I'm going with 6. It's not a, because of its nature, because it's surreal to begin with. It's tough to call them some of these moments WTFs, but that speech that the girl gives that goes on for 7 hours when she's dying, that's gotta be a WTF.
I think everything that happens with the radio station is so friggin' weird. So it's of course it's it's 66.6, the radio is on in every vehicle. Although there's never anything but news announcements. There's no music that fills in the gaps.
Yeah, they played music right off the top because they were playing her.
They're playing her song,
her discography, basically. Yeah. But I love the fact that his name was the DJ's name was Dante. That's
yeah.
Oh, nice.
That's Ellen. That's the character Roxy Gunn played Ellen Dream. The daughter of Ellen.
I think there's a solid WTF in your name. She named her daughter Ellen.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah. So but you're right. She came to the whole point is she's become a big star, big music rock star, and she's come back to Edge City to play some sort of charity event. So the DJ, when she's there for a charity event to promote it, spends the whole time grilling her like a journalist. It's just about her dad and how he's evil and killed people and what's going on and all this stuff. And she's trying to avoid it and say she's here. It was so weird and so out of place.
And my favorite use of, in this reporter's opinion, you're not a fucking reporter. You're a DJ.
You're a DJ. You're not a reporter.
They keep talking about. It actually says at the beginning, it's 30 years after Streets of Fire. You can figure you're going to have to work out the timeline yourself from the details that are presented, because
either so we're led to believe that at the end of Streets of Fire, he leaves. She is presumably already pregnant. Then young Ellen Jr. Yeah. Keeps talking about him as if he left the two of them, like that she remembers that, like not like she never knew him, like and then says like, you know, mom died when I was a baby. And I'm like, well, which was it? Like, was she a huge rock star, or was it like a year after Streets of Fire?
Not to mention, there's no way she looks 30.
Yeah, it's a bit mushy as far as that part goes, and that's the part that's actually in our world. So, I think the weirdest friggin' part, and the thing that will boost this is, I think every element of this that is a sequel to Streets of Fire is so messed up, because I also love Streets of Fire, and as much as I thought there was a lot of heart to make a sequel to Streets of Fire, I mean, it is not a, this ain't The Force Awakens, where it's basically a remake of Streets of Fire, for sure. And then offhand at the end, they say, oh, what actually happened to Ellen Sr. is that Rick Moranis hired Willem Dafoe to kill her.
Yeah.
I'm like, that's messed up. That's a weird takeaway from this movie.
Not to mention, you know, this guy who everybody's talking about how he's so evil, he shows up to her concert and just hangs around, and like no police show up, nobody texts. Like he's like this infamous character, and he's just hanging there, and everything's fine.
And he can get backstage in the concert without even like doing anything. He doesn't even like, he's in Vegas and wandering around the back streets, which I will say is one of the best examples of guerrilla filmmaking ever. It's like, I'm going to hang out in this alley shooting. You run across the street. Okay. We're going to show some of Vegas in the background.
Pretty much.
I love that. You were talking about the, you know, of course, most of the film is shot on a green screen. The room tone is clearly like a big empty room.
Yes.
All of these scenes that are done on the green screen take place outside in the middle of the desert, and the echo of the sound is very clearly a closed room. Mm-hmm. And not a terribly big one at that, it sounds like.
Well, it's probably his like basement.
it gave all of the acting in that this surreal feel of like it was theater. Not like it was movie acting, but like because of the sound quality and everything, it's like, you know, it's like they're in a, like they're on a stage as opposed to a sound stage. I'm up to an 8 on this, primarily based on how this relates to Streets of Fire. Memorable moments.
I'm going to remember this for how confused and how strange this was. From the visual aesthetic of this movie is never going to leave my head. I guarantee that. Like, when I think of Road to Hell, I'm going to be thinking of, like, oversaturation, you know, like, crushed blacks and weird colored skies and green screens and just all this, you know, melange of stuff. Am I going to remember the storyline? Almost for certain not. I'm going to forget what happened for sure. And certainly the rather tenuous connection to Streets of Fire, that's not going to stay. But visually.
Was there a number there?
No, I was just saying visually, I'll remember it. So I'll give it.
It was a dramatic pause.
Yeah, I thought you were.
Kind of reminds me of her speech at the end when she's dying.
Yes, which takes 40 minutes. I actually thought that you were going to say something, Jim. So that's why I was like, oh, am I? Nope. I'll give it a 6.
I watched this about 14 hours ago. I have successfully 70% purged 30% of this movie from my mind, thankfully. in that time. And I think two more viewings of Streets of Fire may just do it almost completely. So I'm only going to give it a 3.
Wow. I love the music. I'll remember a lot of that. I bought the soundtrack, so that's clearly going to stick with me. I think Roxy Gunn. I mean, I don't know if we can get her on this podcast in some way, but the guys that are our hosts, sponsor site We Talk Podcast as a We Talk Music, and maybe they can interview her. I think the music's definitely going to stick out for me, and the surreal. Like, I'm fairly certain they filmed the entire film, not just on the green screen, but put Vaseline on the camera to give it that.
Well, they were playing with the effects like crazy. They yeah, went through all.
Like
them.
I say, that surreal dreamlike quality will stick with me. I will remember this movie for a long time. So I got a 9.
I am. Wow, it's a category I'm below someone else. the music is the primary thing for me. Because I couldn't find the film for so long, I had actually seen Roxy Gunn's songs on YouTube because that was the only thing I could find. And her version of Nowhere Fast, I really, really like. So I'm an 8 on this one. Crazy concept.
There's none crazier. It's a 10.
yeah, it's pretty freaking crazy. 9.
I also got a 9 on the craziness. I don't know much more can be said if you've listened to what we talked about at this. Like, you don't know why it's a 9 or a 10.
All right. And I am a 10 on this as well. He's pitching to himself. Yes. Maybe he's pitching to his wife. Do you want to spend some of our savings on this fan fiction film to settle a household bet? But we're going to make a sequel to this movie I absolutely love that we will not have the rights to and doesn't actually make sense in the context of the original. So 10 for me.
But I gave Michael Paré a call and he'll come out for a couple of days.
Yeah. Mike owes me a favor, and he said he'd turn up. all right. Each season we have 6 secret modifiers. This film does not pick up any of them, but this season we have what is called the Will of the Gods, which is I roll an 8-sided die, and if it comes up an 8, then the gods punish the film.
This almost feels like a movie that should get punished.
Yeah, it's like... Think about it. It's the Will of the Gods. This is a film that takes place in purgatory. Like, if there's any connection, if there is any sort of actual afterlife or anything out there in control of things, it will control it right here and give us an 8.
All right. Apparently, Jack will believe in at least the Saints of Boogaloo, if not any other higher power. Nope. F is a 4.
So no movie was punished in our
no movie was punished this season. Yeah, the gods have smiled on us. We'll put it that way. That does bring this film to a.
No, they did make us watch Food Fight.
considering where we started this episode, that brings it to a very surprising to me, 79.5.
Oh my God! Really?
Which. I'd have to do the counting 3, 4, 5. It puts it just on the edge of the top 10, I think.
It's the
third highest of the season. Just right behind Raw Force and ahead of Hots.
Wow.
Boosted by a couple of categories with gigantic numbers.
Well, sure. Because when you're talking between the fact that it's just the whole. Concept behind it and of him self-funding this, that's so nuts. The fact that he did it and the fact that he did it, it's like that, yeah. Those two, yeah. Totals just and, incredible.
One of the most interesting movies we've ever done, without any question. Not the one of the best, but one of the most interesting.
It's reflected there. It's not easy to watch at all, but at the same time there's no question that it's amazing.
It is. It was an experience for sure.
Yes.
The octagon giveth, it taketh away.
So tell me, Jim, did you, after you watched it, did you expect this movie to take over the top slot, or were you kind of like, no, I know this one's not going to do it?
I did not select it, despite my own scores being like giving it a very high score myself. I didn't really look for movies for this category.
Yeah.
I would have only had to look for one, because I was going to put in the goddamn The Sand.
Yes, of course. See, I did, because I wanted to kind of go with the flow, because I was thinking to myself, I don't know if I love this or really hate this, but at the same time, I want to hear what the general consensus is, because I could have been tipped either way. And I think, you know, as we talked, I realized, yeah, no, it's something. So that's great.
Something.
All right. Jim, do some business, and then we can get on to choosing our one shit wonders.
All right. You're asking yourself, what is that octagon they keep talking about? Well, it is our ongoing record of all of the scores for the films that we do, sortable by the total score and by each of the five categories. And if you click on the Octagon page on We Talk Podcasts, then it will take you to each individual episode. So you know, if you watch a movie and you're like, what do the guys think of that? This is the way you do it. That is WeTalkPodcast.com. They also have a Facebook. They also have a Twitter, and we are on Instagram at Kung Fu Electric Boogaloo. And please subscribe on your favorite podcast app and or on YouTube.
Preferably, so we can make some money.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. We're starting to get some regular listeners on the YouTube.
All right, go money.
People apparently it's because people can't go out anymore. They're stuck looking for anything, and they're like, "What the hell? I could do worse."
That's right, and you could.
I've listened to other podcasts. You could do worse.
Yeah. Can you do better? Absolutely. Yeah. But you could do worse.
As I said about this movie, it's not the best, it's not the worst, but it might be the weirdest.
Yeah, much
the same.
All right.
We're going to pick our next movies, and I'm really hoping you guys pick a couple that I was going to pick, because I have like five, and I have not 100% decided yet. Especially there's like three top ones. But first, I'm just really curious, because this is the first time we did this. I had said maybe we make this an annual event. What do you guys think of the concept, Enter the Octagon? Do you see it coming back?
I found it challenging, because I've been wanting to get back to a tighter themed season. Some of the early seasons of the space movies, the like teen sex comedies, like something with a bit more theme, because the jumping around is tough. Like the going from Food Fight to Terror in Beverly Hills to Road to Hell is a really rough ride.
Sure,
it's really hard to compare apples to oranges.
That's not apples to oranges. That's like apples to fucking like pasta.
But it's Boogaloo to Boogaloo still. And you're not like, comparing them to each other. You're comparing them only to what you would score them, right?
Yeah. I think having done it, I would do it again, but I would probably think through the seasons differently that I was putting into it. Yeah, I think I would make changes to that part.
I think we could do it again while still trying to find maybe something that ties them together a little bit more. But maybe it comes back. Maybe not 1 year. Maybe in 2 years. But I would like to see a sequel. If nothing else, it gave us some high scoring films and our lowest scoring film of all time by far.
Yes.
Which means it was a huge success.
Yeah, I mean, I love the fact that for me, it was a great way to get some movies where it's just like, well, maybe I didn't necessarily have a great concept for more movies for the season, but I really wanted to get a couple of movies into the Octagon, and I got those movies into the Octagon.
Well done.
All right, well, speaking of those movies, one of those movies actually is our winner, and that one, thank you, Miami Connection, for giving us One Shit Wonder. Now, One Shit Wonder is, of course, the season where Let's see, now, somebody that's a massive part of it, and in the case of Miami Connection, it's YK Kim, just basically the reason that that movie existed, and it's the only thing that he's basically done of any real import and I'll say value, because I found a great amount of value in watching that movie. And so that's the concept of it. It's that one hit wonder. Well, you've got, in the movie B-movie world, you've got the one shit wonder. So... We're gonna talk about we're gonna have some 8-1 shit wonders coming up.
All right,
Jimmerite.
Yes, as always, we decide the order of choosing by the Jimmerator, and it is Nick.
Thank you.
Now, I was under the impression it was a director, not just somebody.
Nope.
Am I correct on this?
Nope.
It could be anyone. Doesn't matter. I'm quite happy with my picks anyway. From the directorial team of Lou Kenny and Brendan D. Wilde, they only did one film, but it does have Bolo Young breakdancing. Nice. I'm picking from 1991, Breathing Fire.
Mm. No, see, I'm already excited about this season.
Yeah, that's awesome. You had me at Bolo Young, and then you throw in breakdancing?
Yes.
Dude.
In drag.
This is the only film that that these guys directed or wrote, or what was the deal again?
It has two credited directors. IMDb lists a third who has directed something else, but he is not on the Wikipedia page.
So additional scenes or something. It's usually
so it's additional scenes. He's listed as a producer, but Lou Kenny and Brendan D. Wilde are the only ones on the film itself listed as a director.
Cool. Crazy. And it's their only directing credit.
Yes.
Okay.
Lou Kenny has one other, but
Yeah, that's right.
20 years earlier and is a short, so I don't count
it. I wouldn't count a short. No,
that doesn't count. If it does, then my picks are screwed.
Yeah, exactly.
A short or a music video or anything like that doesn't count. Even if it's like, we'll get to that. all right. Jimmerate. Jack.
Damn you! I pass.
No passing.
Damn it. I gotta make a choice here. God, this is so tough. I'm gonna go with Stephen Cheadle has only directed one film. He has directed a couple TV series, but only one film. He's mainly a special effects guy. The one film is infamous, and he is apparently, there is announced that he's going to do a sequel to it, but it hasn't come out yet, and they've announced this a sequel to this film numerous times. Of course, the film I'm talking about is the legendary Killer Clowns from Outer Space.
All right, then.
I'm next. I'm going deep into my VHS memory. This is a thriller, horror, sci-fi that I saw on VHS way back in the days of renting from your local VHS, even before the Blockbuster days. This film was directed by Saul Bass, who's primarily known for title sequences of movies.
That's right.
He did one half
of Rankin Bass.
That's right. He incredibly successful, only directed one feature film himself. So he did graphic design, he did posters, he did the openings for Hitchcock films. Incredible career, only one film credit as director. It is 1970s Four's Phase Four about desert ants.
Wow. Whoa. So good.
That sounds like it can't lose.
or we can't win. One or the other.
One or the other.
All right, Stan, that leaves you for the first four.
Okay, well, my choice is directed, produced, written by Cullen Blaine. Who is Cullen Blaine, you may ask? Well, he's directed an episode of Kid Notorious, Belle's Magical World, Hey Arnold, Garfield and Friends, The Get Along Gang, Dennis the Menace, and Mayday for Mother. But in 1987, he obviously made the movie that he really wanted to make, which is called Rotor. It's a science fiction action movie, but also known as Blue Steel and Rotor Police Force. And when you when I say Rotor, I mean I'm like R.O.T.O.R. Like, there's nothing that would ever tie this to anything else he has ever done before in his life.
Crazy. It looks wacky.
Yes.
More than a little wacky. All right, we're in the back half of what will be next season, season 12, and Stan, you're back up.
Okay. Well, my next choice. So, does anybody remember Hollywood Squares? Back in, you know, 86 to 89, 98 to 2004. Does anybody remember the announcer voice of Hollywood Squares way back then?
Shadow Stevens. Of course, dude.
Yes. Well, back in 1988, Shadow Stevens was tapped to be a star of his own action movie.
Oh, no.
This movie is called Trax. T-R-A-X-X.
Oh, yeah.
He is a mercenary turned cookie maker.
So I have chosen
Trax as movie number two because I remember it being really awful and really cheesy. And so I'm looking forward to seeing it again after about 30 freaking years.
And I remember you telling me about that all those years ago.
Yeah, and putting it up to the Boogaloo lens. And so this is the only starring role that he's ever had. Typically, he's just an announcer.
Well, he was in Dave's World as Dave's best friend, Dave Barry's best friend, played by the great, late, great Harry Anderson.
Yes, but that was just a TV show.
That's true.
Yeah, one feature film. I think that makes sense.
That makes sense.
All right.
That qualifies.
I'm up next. I may be cheered. I may be booed, either now or when we do it.
Are you giving us State Park again?
I was like, you can't do Food Fight again.
And the sand did not qualify, unfortunately.
Oh, but if it had.
1994, a team of writers fresh off of Late Night with David Letterman. And one of the writers was also the director. He has never directed anything since, although he has stayed working. He has stayed a very successful writer. This is 1994's Cabin Boy.
Cabin Boy.
Yay! Chris Elliott. Oh my God.
Well, from a Boogaloo lens, it will be interesting.
It will be interesting. I love Cabin Boy. I think Cabin Boy is fantastic in how amazingly funny it is.
Save it for the show.
Yes.
Don't get it. Be in 2 months, we have to talk about it. So. Yeah, no doubt. Hold it in.
please pick me. Right,
it's me. And
Jack.
It is Nick.
Yes.
Jack gets to go.
Okay.
Please, Nick, don't choose anything that's on Jack's list.
Yeah, please.
I think we're safe from that, actually.
Yeah.
Damn it.
Blade Runner, 12 Monkeys, Unforgiven, and Soldier are all written by David Weber Peoples, who has only directed one film, and it happens to be one of my favorite B movies of all time. Blood of Heroes, Football with a Dog Skull. Starring Rutger Hauer, Joan Chen, Delroy Lindo, and Vincent D'Onofrio.
Wow.
This is going to be a treat.
Have we had Rutger Hauer We had him once, right?
I don't think
was he
we
in
have.
Was he in Class of 1999? Was he in that?
I don't think so.
Nope. No, the Stacey Keach was
oh,
in
that
the
was
one
Stacey Keach. Yeah, that's what I was thinking of. All right, Jack, okay. Wrap it up.
All right, make sure I want to make sure this qualifies under your rules here. This gentleman, it's the only thing he's written. He wrote this movie as a starring vehicle for himself to become the next big martial arts action star in 1998. Since then, he has been working as an actor, though they have been roles such as henchman, nunchuck guy, guard. And then eventually he finally got a role in 2020 as an actual character after this came out in 1998. It's the only thing he wrote. He wanted to make himself a big action star. It is legendary. The first martial arts movie to come out of Ireland. The actor writer is James P. Bennett. The movie is Fatal Deviation. And I guarantee you this will amaze you guys.
All right. I mean,
does it qualify?
Sounds good to me.
Okay.
I mean, anytime anybody is attempting to take themselves and write a vehicle for themselves and it doesn't work, then that's a one shit wonder right there.
Oh, it doesn't work. Okay. I have to say, I consider Freddy Got Fingered.
Oh, yes.
I did consider that.
I had one other movie, which would fit nicely into another season, but I was considering Deathbed, The Bed That Eats.
Yeah. Mm. And there's also Killer Couch. Don't forget that one. I think you have to do those together. I think we have to find a season of furniture killing people. If we can do that as a season, then we'll be good.
I mean, inanimate objects that kill people, but yeah, like the Deathbed, The Bed That Eats, made by a bookstore owner who never made another movie. So it's like, oh, it was tough. But then I came across Tracks and thought, Shadow Stevens, fucking A.
Tough to top that.
All right. Well, now I'm crazy excited for next season, One Shit Wonder. So yeah, I don't have anything more to say. Anybody else? Apparently not. All right. Let's get to watching some movies.
Yeah.
All right.
See you back here for Breathing Fire.
I ain't waiting 2 months. Nope. We got to get this going right away. These movies sound incredible.
You know it. All right. For Jim and for Jack and for Nick, I am your host, 8th Dan Stanadu, and thanks for listening to the Kung Fu Electric Boogaloo.
Soldier. Killing is what he does. It's all he knows.
Police are looking for two suspects believed to be females, approximately 20 to 30 years old, traveling south. Both are considered armed and extremely dangerous.
Hello, Cody.
Where do you think Cody is right now?
Cody's alone, out there, waiting.
Waiting for what?
Ellen. I need to see her.
She's a big fucking rock star, Cody. What do you expect?
We all have our dark side.
Who I've killed.
I bet you chicks got a lot of skills.
No, I've needed you my whole life, asshole.
Isn't killing Ellen enough?
ever need something, I'll be there.